Welcome to Freud Museum and to this evening's talk. I'm Carol Siegel, director of the Freud Museum, and it's a real pleasure to welcome you all here tonight. I'm sure it's an audience of animal lovers come to hear Laurel Breitman. Just before introducing her, just to say that you're actually sitting in the middle of our new exhibition, which is called Freud and Eros, Love, Lust and Longing. And the exhibition room is behind you. So I don't want to distract from Laurel's talk, but if you haven't had a chance to have a look around, you might like to briefly at the end or come back. And also we have quite a number of events on with the exhibition, so please do pick up one of these What's On leaflets and have a look and see if there's anything else that attracts your interest. But I think tonight's talk is going to be great. It's a real pleasure to welcome Laurel here, and I understand that you actually came here and did some of your research in the archive, though I'm not sure it then made it into, from what you were saying, that it made it into the book. Laurel is a historian of science. This is her first book, but as you may well know, if you're here tonight, it's been incredibly well received. All sorts of, you know, favourable reviews and interest and praise. Laurel's been profiled in The Observer, The New Yorker, and has just been in England for a few days, promoting the book. So I think we're very lucky to have the chance to hear her. Just to say as well, the book, if you are interested, is on sale in our shop, which is down below. At the end of the talk, please, if you want to continue the conversation with Laurel, please can you go down to the shop to do so? Because then that will make it much easier for those people who do want to buy the book and get it signed. So I'm sure you'll be happy to continue the conversation but downstairs rather than here. Anyway, thank you very much and look forward to hearing what you have to say.
Hi. Thank you guys so much for coming out. I really appreciate it. Thank you, the Freud Museum, and Carol for having me here, and the lovely, good women of Scribe, my UK publisher, who's... Hi. Photographing me awkwardly right now. This is a joy to be in this house. I think this is a ground zero for a kind of curiosity that has informed my own life and probably so many of you all. I did come here when I was researching the book because I was wondering if Freud had ever wondered about the inner lives of animals, particularly as he grew older and dogs became such an important part of his life. And I urge you, my favorite thing when I was here last, and Carol, you can tell us if this is still the case, there's like traces of dogs all over the house, embroideries of dogs in Anna Freud's room. And I guess normally here there would be clips from the family home movies in which the dogs appear. And I did sort of a dog scavenger hunt around the house, and there was so much. Unfortunately, Freud doesn't seem to have left too many thoughts on his ideas about the inner lives of animals, and I think that's unfortunate that someone who is perhaps one of the most interested people in the inner workings of the human mind in the 20th century didn't turn his gaze onto non-human animals. Or maybe he did, but he certainly didn't publish about it, and he didn't leave too many traces. And the one thing I could find, which was great, was he visited Central Park, and he was sitting on a bench, and he was writing to his wife. And he said that, he was sitting with his wife, but he was writing to another analyst. And a squirrel came down and hopped on the bench. And he said something in this letter like, I give the little creatures I extend to them the capacity for interesting inner lives. like you could tell he was like taken by this one squirrel and like the day in the park in New York. And then that's really it. So maybe there's more that I'm missing, but, so I'd like to sort of continue that thread, which is, all of us, I think, become interested in the inner lives of other animals because we run into an animal that inspires us to ask questions in a way that we haven't been before. And for me, I grew up on a farm. I was always surrounded by other animals, in particular donkeys, a pony, a parrot. A lot of them were, like, misbehaving, but I never would have said that they had anything like mental illness or mental disorders. And I wasn't someone that didn't think animals had emotions, but had you told me that dogs could have anxiety disorders or post-traumatic stress, or that parrots could suffer from obsessive compulsions, or that elephants could have phobias of certain things in their environment, I think I would have told you that it was very anthropomorphic. And then I fell in love, and like so many of us, you know, we don't think we believe in a certain thing until love changes us on such a fundamental level, and that happened to me. And I fell in love with a dog. His name was Oliver. He looked exactly like this dog on the front of the book, sort of that same mournful gaze. But he was so soft and fluffy. And when it was snowing, he was just so happy. And the first 6 months with him was like a honeymoon. It was incredible. My ex-husband and I, we pretended to know what he sounded like if he could talk. I don't know how many of you guys do that with your own animals. It's really embarrassing to admit publicly, but most people I know have a dog or cat or bird voice. And we played hide-and-go-seek around the house, and we took him on long walks, and it was really amazing. And then about 6 months in, things started to devolve in a really spectacularly sad way. We really couldn't leave him alone. He turned into like a quaking, inconsolable, horrible mess if he was left alone for even a few hours. And he also developed what he was eventually diagnosed with, which was a canine compulsive disorder. In his case, it meant he would lick and lick and lick himself, even if there was nothing else wrong, until he got huge, horrible wounds. And then we'd have to put him in that sad cone, which I feel like is embarrassing for everyone. And then he would continue to do it. He also hallucinated. He became aggressive. He ate things that weren't food, like fabric, all kinds of things. Some of you are nodding. I am so sorry. It all culminated about a year in when we left him alone for a few hours, and in a particular panic, he pushed a window air conditioning unit out of the way in our house, and he chewed a hole through the metal window screen, somehow held up the window sash as well, and then jumped out of our house. And he fell four floors into a cement stairwell of the basement apartment. And he weighed about 125 pounds, so that the size of a rather small person. It should have killed him, but it didn't. And when we got to the veterinary hospital to pick him up, you know, I was distressed and distraught and asked what I should do. And the vet said, you can move to a first floor apartment. And also, here's a prescription for Valium and Prozac. And get yourself to a veterinary behaviorist, which is basically the psychiatrist of the animal kingdom, a veterinarian who specializes in behavioral and emotional problems. And that really was the beginning of all of this. I wanted to know if my dog's anxiety was anything like my own, people that I knew. I wanted to know if his response to Prozac and the anti-anxiety medication would be at all similar to so many people now who are also on these drugs. I'm not sure about the UK, but in the United States, where I live, it's 1 in 5 Americans. The pharmaceutical industry is so powerful. These drugs are now worth more than their weight in gold, you know, per ounce. And I wanted to know how this industry grew to include these creatures, too. And that really set me on a kind of odyssey. Lasted almost 8.5 years. It was the subject of my PhD dissertation, but also, you know, this book, which is written, thankfully, for your sake, if you read it very differently than my PhD dissertation. And really just changed my life in so many ways. Oliver was like my gateway drug to thinking about the rest of non-human kind in a totally new way. Because we are in Freud's house, I think I'll start reading you something. Mentions him a little bit. As word spread among my friends and family about Oliver's weird behavior, they began forwarding me articles about dogs who rouse themselves from depression by making friends with orangutans, or links to stories about Scotland's Overton Bridge, otherwise known as the, quote, dog suicide bridge, where a number of dogs are said to have mysteriously plunged to their deaths, but who may merely have been following the scent of rabbits or foxes. Most of these articles I filed away in a rumpled folder labeled Animal Crackers, but a few caught my eye. In the wake of the Iraq War and during the ongoing armed conflict in Afghanistan, stories of anxious canines, such as, quote, military dogs also suffer post-traumatic stress disorder, or war dogs are taking Xanax for puppy PTSD, or more military dogs show signs of combat stress, and four-legged warriors show signs of PTSD, popped up in the popular media. Reporters marveled at the novelty of these walking psychologically wounded. But all I could think about was how this news was perhaps not quite as novel as the journalist suggested. Ivan Pavlov, whose work almost a century ago focused on disordered dogs, wouldn't have been surprised at all. The Russian physiologist was interested in far more than the conditioned responses to cues that famously sent his dog salivating. Pavlov spent decades exploring the physiological basis for human neuroses and the relationship between disordered human and canine minds. He even lived out the last years of his life as a researcher inside a clinic for nervous diseases, attempting to help disturbed human beings. Pavlov's life work set the stage for much of our contemporary understanding of the effects of trauma on human behavior, memory, and mental health, and it's one of the main reasons that today's dogs of war can be said to have PTSD. Pavlov became interested in canine neurosis after reading Freud's writings about his patient, Anna O. She put on a happy face while caring for her terminally ill father, whom she loved deeply. Anna did this for his benefit, hiding her own feelings of despair and loss. Freud believed this internal conflict gave rise to her neurosis. So Pavlov wanted to stimulate this kind of neurosis in his dogs, the same kind that he felt Freud was writing about in Anna O. So he tried to create confusion in his dogs, and he did this by shocking them nonsensically and giving them treats nonsensically. So they would learn that a certain shock or a certain sound would mean that a treat's coming, and then they would suddenly stop. And they would reverse all of the things the dogs knew, and pretty soon the dogs started to lose it. They would bark uncontrollably, they would refuse to get into their experimental apparatus. You know, in many ways this was torturous and terrible. In other ways, Pavlov really learned some interesting things about dogs, and he felt that canine neurosis was a real phenomenon. And this was cemented for him in 1924. I think this is interesting. 1924, his lab flooded in Leningrad, and the dogs almost died. He and a few of his research assistants were able to go in, and they were able to save the dogs. But some of the dogs had come very, very close to drowning. So after the waters receded and they cleaned up the lab, they started doing experiments again. But some of the dogs couldn't stand it when it rained at all, or even if someone spilled some water on the floor of the laboratory. And Pavlov started to take notes about this, and then he simulated a flood in the lab. And what he found was that some of the dogs who lived through the flood were fine. They did not get upset at all about the water in the lab, and others turned into just like really, really anxious messes. And his observation was that, wow, some of us are more emotionally resilient than others. And, you know, we think of this as, like, extremely commonsensical now, but no one had actually published this before. And his takeaways from these flooded dogs really affected what we now consider just, you know, basically common sense about individual difference. I was talking to Carol about this earlier. I don't know that he ever wrote to Freud or that Freud ever read this. You know, certainly he was around and Freud was reading all kinds of things. I'm not sure why the two men did not communicate about it, but they didn't. So this is less true in the UK. In the United States, you know, because the psychopharmaceutical industry is so powerful, many, 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 many of our animals wind up on psychopharmaceutical drugs. And actually, I was at the zoo earlier today and here in London, and they did say that many of their animals have been on these drugs, particularly the great apes, and that they have hired psychiatrists to come in and treat some of the apes. But it's extremely difficult to get statistics about some of this stuff. You know, sometimes I think bringing in a psychiatrist to treat your captive apes and to give them an antidepressant is truly the most compassionate thing that you can do, particularly if you can't change the ape's environment or one ape is hassling another ape or, you know, but it also happens in beluga whales and dolphins. And I'm actually yet to find an animal species, except perhaps elephants, that I haven't seen some trace of psychopharmaceutical use in them, whether it's the antidepressants, anti-anxiety medications, or antipsychotics. This is from a chapter called Animal Farm with a PH. I was, like, super proud of that pun. Life is no way to treat an animal. Kurt Vonnegut. When the reality TV star Anna Nicole Smith overdosed in 2007 on a mix of prescription drugs that included Prozac, her dog Sugar Pie was taking Prozac, too. So was the former French president Jacques Chirac's normally friendly Maltese and Bichon Frise Mix Sumo. The small white dog accompanied him everywhere when he was in office and was often spotted on Chirac's lap as they were chauffeured through Paris in the back of a shiny presidential Citroën. But after Chirac lost the presidency to Nicolas Sarkozy and the family was forced to leave the palace, Sumo lost his appetite. He was also lethargic and not acting like himself. Chirac's wife Bernadette believed that Sumo, used to the large gardens of the Élysée, couldn't adjust to their post-presidential life in a spacious apartment and seemed anxious and depressed. Their vet put the dog on Prozac, but he twice bit the ex-president, hard enough to send Chirac to the doctor. Finally, Sumo was sent away to live on a farm in the countryside with family friends. They say he hasn't bitten anyone since. Sugar Pie and Sumo are not anomalies. Prozac Nation has been offering citizenship to non-humans for decades. Fluoxetine, or generic Prozac, is available in a dizzying array of forms and flavors that call to mind a snow cone stand at a carnival for animals. Pet owners and veterinarians can choose fluoxetine flavors like anchovy, apple and molasses, banana and marshmallow, beef, bubblegum, butterscotch, cherry vanilla, chicken, chocolate mint, double beef, double chicken, double fish, double grape, double liver, double marshmallow, double molasses, orange, peanut butter, peppermint, pina colada, raspberry, strawberry, tutti frutti, watermelon, wintergreen, and as if double fish isn't enough, triple fish. It's deliverable in equally bizarre forms, from chewable pills marketed as gourmets to injections, drops, and transdermal gels for animals who can't or won't swallow pills. What's surprising about all of this is not that we are giving animals psychoactive compounds. It's that we are doing it to help them cope with us, closing a loop of pharmaceutical development that began in non-human animals in the 1950s, transitioned to millions of people around the world, and has now returned to certain animal species. The dosing of other creatures with psychopharmaceuticals also serves as a sort of tacit acknowledgement of emotional and neurochemical parallels between humans and other creatures. You can argue, and people like the veterinary behaviorist Nick Dodman have, that this is not the story of animals taking human drugs, but of humans taking animal drugs. Almost all of the contemporary psychopharmaceuticals, from antipsychotics like Thorazine to minor tranquilizers like Valium to the antidepressants, were developed in the mid-20th century, and animals were test subjects from the very beginning. And this wouldn't be that interesting if it was just that they were test subjects. You know, all of our medications are used on other animals first as test subjects. But what's interesting about the psychopharmaceuticals was that they were tested in other animals for efficacy. You know, the first creatures to take anti-anxiety medications were beagles and cockatoos and monkeys. Rabbits got antidepressants first. Some of the antipsychotic medications were given to beagles and rats and pigeons. It seemed to relax these animals. Their anxiety seemed to lessen. There are animal models for so many disorders, and so many of our new psychopharmaceutical drugs are tested in other creatures first to see if they affect their mental health. And that was really the first time that drug development happened in this kind of a way. Drugs, though, are often only one way, the same in us, to make a creature feel better. You know, I'm pretty critical of just dosing an unhappy animal with psychopharmaceuticals if you don't first try to change other things in their life, just because that also doesn't seem to work with us very well. One thing, though, you know, is that many people that I talked to who had suffering creatures, and also many veterinary behaviorists, told me that if their animals, their patients were humans, they would be in psych wards. They would be in inpatient facilities. But if you have a dog, like one veterinary behaviorist who I really like in New York, she has a golden retriever patient who hurls himself into traffic in anxiety. They live in Manhattan. This is a terrible problem. In order to get this dog from hurling himself into traffic, this dog is on so much Valium it would kill a human being. But she has to have this dog on this amount of Valium in order to do any sort of behavioral training with the dog. Because otherwise the dog is just distraught out of his mind and she can't work with him. And in that way, I think there is an interesting parallel, you know, to human medicine. Sometimes the drugs help give us a pause so that we can do the other things that are going to help us more long term. One thing, though, that I found as I was researching all of this was how much truly really did help and what about it was surprising. And in the case of captive animals, how many of you guys know what enrichment is, that term? Okay, a few of you. Really, that's a fancy way in animal world of saying giving animals things to do. Really, it's things like mental puzzles, giving them exercise, training can be considered enrichment. And I'm going to read you just a little bit about enrichment. Janine Jackal, this is a keeper I really admire at the Franklin Park Zoo in Boston. She's been a gorilla keeper for 25 years. No one knows gorillas, I think, better than this woman, at least that I've met. Janine Jackal says that for enrichment to really work, it must be personalized. Take Gigi, for example, she told me. Gigi is a 36-year-old female gorilla. She really likes to see human feet. I'm not sure why, but maybe it's interesting for her when we take off our shoes and she sees that human feet are like her feet. And yet, I can't exactly ask a zoo visitor to show Gigi her feet, even though that would keep her entertained. Occasionally, though, a zoo volunteer, Gail O'Malley, who's visited the Boston gorillas at least 3 times a week for 27 years, will take off her shoes and wiggle her toes in front of the exhibit's glass windows. Gigi also enjoys watching black and white films that keeper Paul Luther tapes for her off of the American Movie Channel and plays behind the scenes from a TV VCR on a rolling cart. The Franklin Park Zoo's now deceased mandrill named Ushindi also liked to watch television, especially Disney feature films. His shelf of DVDs at the zoo included Free Willy and Free Willy 2, 101 Dalmatians, and oddly enough, National Geographic African Wildlife. Recently, the Wilhelma Zoo in Stuttgart, Germany, installed a flat-screen TV inside the bonobo exhibit. The apes can toggle between different channels, streaming short clips of bonobo life. Bonobos eating and searching for food, a female being tender with infants, two males fighting, play scenes, and bonobos mating. Surprisingly, the apes haven't seemed very interested in their custom porn channel. A zoo employee told the NBC Evening News that, quote, maybe they are not so interested as bonobo apes very often have sex anyway. Sometimes what stimulates captive animals the most are the humans staring back at them. James Brahini, the director of the Bronx Zoo, said of the multi-million-dollar Congo Gorilla Forest exhibit, quote, we thought we were building this great exhibit for people to look at gorillas. We found we were building a great exhibit for gorillas to look at the people. Kate Brown has been a docent in this exhibit for more than 10 years. She's convinced that the gorillas' favorite time of year is Halloween, when children and adults come to the zoo on 2 different weekends in October dressed in costume. The gorillas get really interested in all the funny hats and colors, she said. As we watch dozens of visitors filter past the viewing windows and tap on the glass near a small female picking her teeth with a twig. The gorillas come right up to the glass and look. It's something different for them. Unfortunately, the rest of the year, humans tend to be really boring. Great groups of us come into the observation areas and excitedly point to the gorillas closest to the glass. We say things like, look, a gorilla, or wow. We pull out our phones and digital cameras to take photos, squinting at the tiny screens. We wave always a jaunty, open-palmed human hello to the nonplussed gorillas. We comment to one another on how similar the apes are to us, and then we move on to the Asian monorail, the face-painting booth, the lemurs, or the gift shop to purchase plush giraffes or meerkat-shaped erasers. The gorillas have seen it all before, most of them for years. Gail O'Malley says that there's some surefire ways to engage the apes on the other side of the glass, but that few people do it. One of her favorite games is something she calls, quote, playing purse. Every zoo I've gone to has worked, she said. Gorillas always want to know what's in your bag, but you have to make a game out of it. You can't just dump everything on the floor. Take one item out at a time. It doesn't matter what it is. It could be your sunglasses or your keys, but you have to do it slowly with anticipation and a flourish. So she showed it to me. It's like that. A burlesque routine came to mind, albeit a clothed interspecies one. O'Malley also swears that most gorillas like human babies, something that has been confirmed for me by a number of keepers. She used to take her friends' babies to the zoo to entertain the gorillas since she didn't have children of her own. She says it worked every time. They always came up to the glass to get a good look, especially the females. Kate Brown used to show one of the gorillas in the Bronx a picture book. She really liked to look at the images, Brown said. She was actually somewhat bipedal, too. That is, she'd stand up on her hind legs and walk around like a human, which is not something they're supposed to be able to do for long. But she would see me, and I would come over to the glass and open a book so that she could see it. She'd be standing up on her back legs and then cross her arms over her head and lean into the glass. I'd show her the book, and when she wanted me to turn the page, she would tap on the glass. And I know this might sound crazy, but there's someone in the audience that can attest to this, because earlier today I did a talk for the keepers at the London Zoo, and Sarah was with me, and before we did that, we went to the gorilla exhibit, and it was really crowded. Do you want to say what happened? It was fun.
Yeah, basically, no one started. It was absolutely crowded with people. No one started ducking down behind the barrier, jumping up again, and this gorilla who'd been lying there, just sleeping, effectively, or ignoring everyone, immediately saw her and sat up straight and started staring at her. And then a huge space suddenly appeared around us. Everyone started backing away. And then she took off her shoe and sock and started waving her shoe. And then the gap around us was big. He was really into it.
It's amazing. Like, really, he woke up from, like, a nap and turned around and was suddenly paying attention, you know? And, I mean, maybe it's bothersome in a way, too. I don't really know. But I think in some ways, you know, sometimes a little stress is good for all of us or something interesting and weird. And, you know, I just implore you to go do that. Truly, people will move away from you. They think you are insane. But then they will see the animals interacting with you. And what usually happens is it starts a chain effect of people around you jumping up and down and taking their shoes off. And before you know it, you know, you've given these creatures just, like, 2 minutes of, like, just a little bit of weirdness and something different in their day. And, you know, it's certainly not a cure for emotional suffering, but it's part of the cure. The other thing...
Yeah.
That would be incredible. That would be incredible. I actually do dance for the penguins in... San Francisco. There is the California Academy of Sciences, which is in Golden Gate Park, has penguins, and a lot of the penguins have been hand-raised. And for whatever reason, if you run back and forth on the side of the glass, particularly if something's shiny in your hand, they get really excited, and they'll follow you, kind of step for step. And then if you turn around, you know, they'll swivel, and they'll run back. And I didn't try that today with the penguins at the zoo, but probably, you know, they're most of them, I'm sure, are hand-raised. And you'll certainly find the ones that seem playful. It's just a really interesting thing to do, and I think it's a reminder, too, that there's someone in there. You know, because also you'll see, like, the one penguin who's really bored by you, you know, and then one that's interested. And it's just a nice reminder of animal personality in a really interesting, super straightforward kind of a way. The other thing that I found to be extremely helpful among people that I talked to who devoted their lives to making animals well was the importance of service animals. And we tend to think about service animals as dogs that we put little jackets on and been through training and help us. But really, in the animal kingdom, a service animal can be any kind of species. And I used to think all of those internet forwards, you know, with, like, the orangutan making friends with the dog and the elephant and the dog or the parrot and the... whatever. You know, my mom forwards these to me a lot. I don't know about you guys. I get a lot of them. I think it's a huge part of the internet. You know, they're not as anthropomorphic and as cutesy, I think, as we tend to think. Or if they are anthropomorphic, it's quite all right. You know, that's one thing people ask me a lot, and I'm not too defensive about it. I am an extreme anthropomorphizer. You know, I don't put animals in little outfits. I admit it, I talk for my dog, but I don't pretend to think I know what he's thinking. But I think that that's okay, and I think that the challenge for any of us who live with other animals or even just think about them is not how to not anthropomorphize, because we really can't do that. You can't take your brain out of your human head and put it in a jar and then think about another animal thinking in some objective fashion. That just doesn't work. We will always be one animal wondering about the emotional or other experience of another animal. And so I think we can choose to wonder and anthropomorphize well, or we can do it poorly. And doing it well means avoiding being extremely self-centered. It often means being less verbal. It means taking time. It means trying to understand the animals in your life as individuals, not at the species level. You know, we're super comfortable saying, like, well, my boyfriend is scared of heights, or, you know, my mom gets really anxious in the car. But then we'll turn around and say things like, grizzly bears are ferocious, poodles are smart, dolphins are super sexual. You know, like, there are definitely dolphins who are not interested in sex, like, all the time. And I have met a grizzly bear that is not ferocious, and some poodles are idiots. You know, I think we really do need to extend to the rest of the animal kingdom a kind of individuality we usually reserve for people. There's so much to redo. I think I'm just going to read a little bit more. This is the end of the first chapter. And then I want to take questions, because I want to know why you guys are here. Okay. 2 years after Oliver jumped from our apartment, Jude and I traveled to my family's house in Southern California for Christmas. Jude was my ex-husband. He was not ex at the time. We left him at a boarding kennel outside of Boston. By that point, leaving Oliver by himself anywhere but the canine equivalent of a padded cell was untenable. He could hurt himself and destroy furniture, floors, windows, and doors if we left him with friends. Since his jump, we knew we couldn't leave him in our house with a pet sitter. Honestly, if we could have left Oliver in a car for a week with sufficient food and water and someone to come by to walk him a few times a day, he probably would have been fine. He loved the car and was never anxious there, probably because he knew that being in the back seat meant that he was not going to be left behind. But you can't leave a dog alone in your car for a week, even if that's where he's happiest. So we took Oliver to a kennel, where they put him in a large dog run with his bed and a few toys stuffed with treats. The kennel staff walked him twice a day, and we felt confident there was no way he would try to escape and hurt himself. We were wrong. Despite our efforts to help him, Oliver's anxiety at being left alone only increased in the years he lived with us. His storm phobia reduced him to a shaking, inconsolable mess, and it took him hours, sometimes days, to recover. He continued to eat things that weren't food if we left him alone past 5 p.m., and with every passing night, he seemed to hunt for invisible flies for longer periods of time. Whenever Oliver was agitated, which was often, he gnawed things in the apartment. He also became more aggressive at the dog park and snapped at a few young children. We were tired. By that time, Jude and I tried virtually every means of therapy and treatment available to American pet owners. We'd taken him to a veterinary behaviorist, given him first Valium, then Prozac, then both. We practiced behavioral modification and training in an attempt to manage his anxiety. We played him recorded sounds of storms to desensitize him to thunder, and jingled our keys even when we weren't planning on leaving the house. We took him on long walks, then long hikes. We tried to socialize him with other dogs. We gave him toys and treats. We gave him affection. We thought about getting him another animal companion and then decided against it. We tried and failed to give him certainty. When we left Oliver at the kennel that December, Jude and I planned to be away less than a week. My family in California are farmers. And one afternoon, less than 3 days into our trip, Jude, my mom, and I walked to the very top of the hill behind the house. We stood at the property line where rusted barbed wire dipped between the posts like bunting and lemon orchards spread out beneath us. My cell phone rang and then Jude's. I don't remember who picked up first, but I remember what we were told. You're going to have to act fast. We're not sure if he's going to make it. It happened so quickly. We are so sorry. No, we don't know why. Oliver had worked himself into a panic after his afternoon walk and began to anxiously chew on a piece of wood on the door in his dog run. By the time someone noticed what he was doing, it was too late. Couldn't have been going on for more than a half hour, the manager of the kennel told me, but he was panting and making wheezing sounds, and then I noticed how he was standing. Oliver was suffering from bloat. This horrid and probably excruciatingly painful predicament comes about when a dog's stomach fills with air, fluid, or food and twists, putting pressure on other internal organs and possibly cutting off their blood supply. You have about 45 minutes to perform surgery and untwist the stomach before there's irreparable damage. Bloat is notorious for affecting big, deep, barrel-chested dogs, like Bernese Mountain Dogs, St. Bernards, and Basset Hounds. There's no single thing that brings it on, and I couldn't find any research linking anxiety to bloat, but I believe that's what happened in Oliver's case. He was in a frenzy. He was gulping air and chunks of wood. He was agitated and scared. He was alone. When we reached the attending vet on the phone, she told us that Oliver was in the operating room. They'd opened him up as soon as he arrived and unwound his twisted intestines, tacked them aside, and surveyed the damage. She said that it was bad, and she couldn't guarantee that further surgery would help him. She also said that if we went ahead and performed the surgery, we were looking at expenses, including the procedures they'd already done, of between $10,000 and $15,000. You might want to think this over, she said to Jude, but don't think for long because we can't keep him here on the operating table. I looked at the neat geometry of tree rows below us and began to cry. I thought of Oliver's soft body on a steel table, his flanks splayed open, his heavy, unknowing head. Jude put his arms around me and said something, but I don't know what it was. I heard only the blood in my ears and felt a sudden, thudding grief. We called the veterinarian back and told her to put Oliver down. She assured us that he wouldn't feel any pain, that he was already unconscious. I made her promise that she would cradle his head and stroke him while he died, and that she would call him Beast, his nickname, tell him that we loved him. And then I asked lamely, do you think we're bad people? I was remembering the story of a friend's friend in veterinary school who treated a Labrador for extensive injuries after he was hit by a car. The family who brought the dog in loved him, but they couldn't afford the recommended surgeries and decided to put him down. The vet student knew that the dog would survive if the costly treatment was done. She let the family say goodbye to him, and then, after they'd left the clinic, she treated the dog and adopted him herself. I found this story chilling. It was good, after all, that the dog had survived, but shouldn't she have offered to do the work for free and sent him home with his family? As we waited for the vet to call us back and tell us when it was over, I had visions of Oliver bounding out of the hospital with other richer people, or with a soft-spoken lady veterinarian. I thought of him turning around, scanning the sidewalk for us, and then getting into someone else's car. No, the vet said to us, I understand. There's a greeting card that I found in the gift shop of the Sigmund Freud Museum in London, and keep tacked above my desk next to a drawing of a squirrel in a t-shirt shooting heroin. The card is black with bright yellow type and reads, Blessed are the cracked, for they let in the light. Supposedly Groucho Marx said it, though I can't find proof. If he did say it, he probably wasn't referring to neurotic dogs, but he could have been. Oliver died more than 6 years ago now, and when I think about him, I ache. I bet Jude does too, but we don't talk about things like that anymore. We don't talk much at all, actually. We divorced a year after Oliver died, and a few years after that, he stopped taking my calls. I can't say that we broke up because of what happened with Oliver. That would be a lie. Or at least, it wouldn't be the whole truth. I do believe, however, that if Oliver had lived, we may not have broken up when we did. Dogs have a way of gluing people together, even ones who are already coming unglued. Now it feels like I walk around with a few different drafty spaces in my chest. One is in the shape of a dog, and there's at least one more in the shape of a man. And yet, in the years since Oliver died, I've fallen in love again anyway, with half a dozen elephants, a few elephant seals, a troop of gorillas, one young whale, a couple of long-dead squirrels, and a handful of men and women who came into my life as if they'd been tugged there by invisible leashes. I'm not sure I would have found any of these creatures otherwise. Losses and disappointment can do that if you're lucky. Before you know it, your pain has welcomed the world. That's what happened to me anyway. One anxious dog brought me the entire animal kingdom. I owe him everything. Thank you. I should tell you guys, just so it's not too sad, this is the first event I've done since I got a new dog. It took me a really long time, but I have a new dog, and it's really good, and he's so different. And I went to every shelter and was like, please give me one that doesn't have separation anxiety. But you don't know. But so far, it's going quite well. He has his issues, like we all do, but they're manageable. Anyway, I would love to hear from you guys if you have any questions. Yeah, inside, gorilla inside. I love that.
Yeah, gorilla. Yeah, I was wondering, is that one-way trip, this anxiety thing in animals, or have you noticed any natural or unnatural ways that we show progress?
That we share progress with them?
Show progress in treating it.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think my experience was, I think, an exception in large part, you know, that I couldn't help my dog. For most people and most animals that I spoke to, it was like a cornucopia of therapeutic interventions really helped. So things like psychopharmaceuticals in some cases, friendships with other members of their same species or with us, or different species entirely, more exercise, behavior therapy or training, you know, which is basically the same as behavior therapy, just in other animals, time. Gigi, that gorilla who likes to see feet, she had severe, like, post-traumatic stress and anxiety that responded to no pharmaceutical intervention whatsoever, and she actually ended up with a psychiatrist from Harvard, because she was in Boston. And the psychiatrist, you know, put together a whole case history, managed her care, she got off the meds, and she's fine now. This was, like, 12 years ago. She's great. And for her, it was largely friendship with the other female gorillas who grew up around her and basically modeled for her a less anxious behavior, how to respond when something kind of went nuts in her environment. She'll always be a more sensitive to gorilla, but she's about 1,000 times better. So exercise seems to help so many of us. You know, and I think it changes, like, just like with us, with them, you know, maybe a drug will work for 2 years and then it stops working and then you've got to go find something else. Or, you know, maybe certain hours of exercise help and then it stops and then you introduce them to, you know, another dog or a parrot. Two people came to a reading of mine recently and they had had a African gray parrot, you know, who are very famous for being so intelligent, who was plucking out all of her feathers. And they tried all kinds of things to help this parrot stop plucking. And then they adopted two chihuahuas. And the parrot hates the chihuahuas. But the chihuahuas are obsessed with this little plastic ball. And so what the parrot does is the parrot goes and gets the ball and then has learned the names of the chihuahuas. It gets up on a tall table or like a sideboard or something. And she stands there with the ball and she calls the chihuahuas over. And then she drops the ball on their heads. And she does this all day long. And all of her feathers are back. Like, she just needed something to torture, you know, and like something to keep her motivated to like stop with the plucking, you know, and they had tried Xanax. I mean, they had tried everything. And what really worked were like two chihuahuas she could heckle, you know, heckle. So, you know, I think it's so, that's what, you know, if there's one takeaway from this, at least for me, it's the individualized piece of this. And also the hopefulness, you know, I mean, you can't really write a prescription for two chihuahuas to bother, you know. It was sort of accidental what worked, but I think that's how so many of us also deal with mental health, which is that, like, you don't actually really know what it is that's going to work until you do it. And so you just sort of have to try everything. Torture, really, of others. Innocent animals, in torture. Yeah.
Great. Are you, in terms of Oliver, you've tried absolutely everything.
Yeah.
And you're also talking about the Labrador that kept running into traffic.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Are you saying that, you know, there are some animals that are just, as there are sort of some people that are just beyond help for whatever reason. I mean, the Labrador in particular sounds suicidal.
Yeah.
You know.
Yes. I am. I mean, I hate saying that, you know, because I want to believe that all of us can get better, but I mean,
you
I
do.
Think,
so
yeah. Exactly. Like, you know, sometimes you've tried everything and it's not enough, you know. Or someone just wants to not be here so badly. Like, I have a whole chapter on animal suicide, which I think, like, the furthest place you can stretch this parallel. And I was most curious about that. And, you know, I can't say for sure whether or not other animals can commit suicide. What I can say is that we should give them the benefit of the doubt, because the most extreme form of self-harm, and we all self-harm, and sometimes some of us die. So human suicide, right, unfolds along a continuum. Sometimes someone kills themselves, and it's very thought out, and it's planned in advance, but sometimes you do yourself in because you're in such pain, you do whatever it is to escape the moment that you're in, and it may not be so premeditated, but you're making a choice away from whatever pain you're in, and I think some animals do it like that. You know, and they've had, like, enough.
I mean, because it sounds, I struggle with it because it sounds quite anthropomorphic.
Yeah, definitely.
But at the same time, I suppose you can argue, so you can argue it's a primal instinct.
I mean, it's just,
why wouldn't an animal
do that? I mean, so much of this, like, if you think about the majority of mental health issues that people struggle with, they're usually some manifestation of fear and anxiety disorders. And then once you get into OCD, it's mostly grooming behaviors gone awry. You know, like, compulsively groom it. Like, mice and rats will compulsively wash their paws, you know, just like we do. And ritualized behavior. And, you know, most of these things are really healthy animal activities that have just gone a bit awry. So feeling fear and anxiety is really good if you're in a dangerous situation. They help all animals move away from danger. The problem is if you feel fear and anxiety in a situation that's not dangerous and it begins to take over your life.
Are there any psychological disorders that affect non-human animals but don't affect humans that we are aware of?
That's such an awesome question. No. And I wish we did. Like, there's a neuroscientist whose work I love. His name is Jacques Panksepp. If any of you guys have not watched this video, it's like maybe my favorite YouTube video, which is saying a lot. It's a rat laughter experiment, and he tickles a bunch of rats, and he has like a transducer so you can hear them laughing, which is so neat. So normally we can't hear rat laughter or also rat moaning, and he like puts his hand in, he stirs it. It's like very clear they're chittering and laughing. In any case, he writes a lot about animal emotional experiences and has argued that there's so many animal emotions we don't have names for because they go with physiological experiences that we don't have. So, like, what's the bee emotion for seeing the UV spectrum? Or what's the dolphin emotion for hearing sonar from a friend you haven't heard in 30 years? Or what's the octopus emotion for a color change? Like, we have no idea, like, what that feels like. And we don't have language to then talk about that feeling in them. And because of our experience and so many other creatures, that, you know, at least that I've seen, I feel like all of us who have emotional experiences can have them happen in inopportune moments or in ways that then cripple us in a lot of ways. Like, if you feel fear, some of us are going to learn to feel fear inappropriately. If you feel anxiety, some of us are going to feel anxious in situations where we shouldn't be anxious, and it starts being a problem. My guess is that if you have an emotion that goes with sonar, that can also get wonky sometimes. Or if you're an elephant and you have infrasound and you have lots of emotional experiences that go with infrasound, you can probably develop an infrasound disorder. But how on earth are we going to talk about that? So I think it's fascinating, you know, like, what disorders might bats have that we just have no idea because we don't inhabit their sensory world. I don't know. If you can think of a way to write about this, you know, I'd do it. I think it's so interesting. What else? Yeah, of course.
You talk about all the ways in which, I mean, either through pharma or through therapists and so on, try and help animals who are distressed and disturbed.
Yes.
But is part of the problem just the way that humans forcing animals into situations which are really unnatural and are causing stress? So, I mean, obviously animals in zoos, however enlightened the zoos are, the animals are not living in their natural habitat. Mm-hmm. A lot of pets that we keep living in very cramped surroundings without access to the outside. I mean, so is there a step back, which is really that we shouldn't always be putting animals in these situations which is going to cause them to become distressed?
Absolutely. You know, at heart, I'm an advocate, you know, which is why I was interested in this in the first place. Like, I wanted to help my own dog, but I was also interested in what are we doing as a species that we could do better or differently. And certainly the majority of animals who suffer actually are food animals and those we raise, you know, for fur and all kinds of things. So yes, we drive animals crazy. Certainly. But, you know, what I found when I started looking into this was it's also way more complicated than that. You can have, you know, for example, companion animals, we are their natural habitat. You know, dogs wouldn't exist in their current form without us, and they have evolved to live with us. They haven't evolved to be alone all day and deal with us looking at screens as much as we do and not getting enough exercise and all these things. But, you know, you can have two dogs who come from the same litter, they're raised in the same household, they are both given lots of exercise, and one is going to develop, like, debilitating fear of vacuum cleaners and is not going to be able to deal with the house getting clean, and the other one is going to be fine. And I think in that way it's so similar to us. You know, we are born into this crazy world with whatever capacities and instabilities and mysteries that we have as individuals, and then life happens to us, and some of us respond in ways, you know, that are different. That is the same with them. So certainly, you know, an animal who's living in a non-ideal situation is going to suffer more, but not always. You know, like every gorilla that's like compulsively regurgitating her food, or every dolphin that's compulsively masturbating, or like this bonobo that was like so disturbed and wound up in Milwaukee and like that's in the book, like he shared his enclosure with lots of bonobos who were fine. You know, so I think it's also an oversimplification. As much as I want to say we should torture no one, all animals should be fine, you know, I do want to say that, and we should, but that's not also the answer. Also, lots of wildlife develop really bizarre behaviors, and we have done nothing to them. I talk a lot about California sea lions in the book who've developed really self-destructive behaviors. They do things like swim out into the middle of the ocean. And sea otters, lots of creatures are exposed to a parasite, toxoplasmosis, gives them us schizophrenia, makes us more likely to commit suicide, also may be making them more likely to be reckless and not scared of things in their environment. So it's complicated. I think we can do things to help, and we do things to hurt, but not always is it our fault. Yeah.
This might be a bit of an obvious question, but do you think your research has any implications for animal rights?
Oh, I mean, I certainly hope so, or I wouldn't have done it.
Yeah.
But it's not that simple of a question, because I think, you know, it's hard because, like, I'm not a vegan. You know, every day I wake up to a message that's like someone from like a zoo somewhere telling me that I have an oversimplified view of zoos in captivity, and then I also have a really angry message from someone who thinks I should be vegan and I'm being irresponsible. So I'm in this like funny place where like neither camp accepts me. But I actually think that's for me, an honest place to be. And I am an advocate at heart, and you can't do this work and like walk away and think we're alone here or that we have all rights to the planet. So, certainly I hope that that's true. That's why there's like 50 pages, literally 52 pages of notes in the back. Because I hope that people will take this and build on it and run elsewhere with it.
Yeah. And you talk about the pharmaceutical.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering, is there any evidence that this could be partly sort of market-driven? Because everything the standards are, you know, it's humans judging what is abnormal behaviour and then deciding whether that needs treated with pharmaceuticals or not. How much just that we don't understand or that we view as abnormal that might not be?
Oh, definitely. I mean, we have a very long history of pathologizing anyone that doesn't fit into whatever cultural norm is appropriate, right? I mean, homosexuality wasn't removed from the DSM completely until 1982. Premenstrual dysphoric disorder, or PMS, entered back into the DSM after being removed as a legitimate reason to prescribe Prozac. Not because, like, all of us women were showing up and being like, we're really suffering here, but because the psychopharmaceutical industry was like, hey, if we get this in the book, this will be a legitimate use of this drug. So you can't separate ever a diagnosis from cultural context. And a big chunk of this, I didn't read you guys any of those bits, but is that our diagnoses have never been stable. They're constantly changing, and they're a function of culture as much as they are everything else. The philosopher of science, Ian Hacking, once said that the most powerful ideological tool of the 20th century was the word normal. And I think that's true, but I also think that word is a weapon. And we've deployed it for people that were inconveniently behaving and other animals for as long as we've had that word. So I think we do have to be really careful about what we're pathologizing. But what's interesting with this is, like, now animals are getting diagnosed with, like, canine OCD or PTSD or separation anxiety, but 100 years ago they were getting diagnosed with mortal melancholy, homesickness, and mortal heartbreak. And if really, if you look throughout history and you look at any time there was a human epidemic, you will see corresponding diagnoses in animals. And if you look even at, like, headlines here in London, like, you know, maybe 1903 to 1920, there's this rash of homesickness in humans and other animals. Also late 19th century, because for the first time, people could travel far away from home at, like, a scale that it wasn't just for the wealthy. And so suddenly you were having people and animals get homesick, and get so homesick they were dying. And so 30 years before that, 40 years before that, you weren't seeing homesickness as a disorder in the same way. So I don't know what we're going to see 50 years from now. You know, already now there's talk about, you know, adding into the DSM, like, internet addiction disorder. And, you know, certainly people couldn't have fear of flying before there were airplanes. So, you know, anything, I'm sure we're going to see, like, canine, like, ADHD soon. You know, like, my dog won't sit still long enough to learn a trick. What do I do? You know, he's so distracted. But I think it's just distractions are the problems of our day. So. Okay, maybe last one. How are you doing?
You're clearly very able to put yourself in a very objective position about all these issues and experience research with a PhD. I just wondered how difficult it was to write about Oliver.
Oh,
as a much more personal subjective experience.
Well, like, I didn't cry tonight. Like, that's good. You know, I am not objective. I'm glad I've, like, pulled the wool over your eyes. I know. I mean, it's super hard to write all about this, except I don't think it's depressing, and I have gotten a bunch of reviews from people. I just, like, you know, read what people are saying on Amazon or whatever, and some people are like, it's so sad. Like, I cried 3 times. I can't finish it. I'm like, oh my God. You know, I think most dog stories, frankly, are sad often, because they don't live as long as us. So loving another animal that doesn't live as long as us is always sad, but God, we do it anyway, and it's great. So I think, you know, part of being a responsible person right now is to be a little scared about the state of the world and to be curious and to be sad sometimes and to be joyful. And I apply that to my work too. You know, yes, it's hard to read all these stories, but it's really important. I also go to zoos because I have so many animal advocate friends who are like, you know, those are terrible places, but you gotta go see the stuff. You know, if you eat meat, you really should go to where the animals are that you're eating. You should know about it all. You can then choose to do it again anyway. But I think we should know. I think, you know, we don't look at great peril. So yeah, it's hard, but worth it. Yes. Maybe with that, we should go downstairs. Yeah. Tell me your stories, though. Come up and tell me your stories, because that's the best part of doing all this. And thank you guys so, so much for coming. I really appreciate it.
And thank you so much.